My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. Those introductions are getting worse every year, Jim. Why don't you tape it earlier in the week and then try to lip sync it? I'm glad to be here tonight. Is that the seat taken by your coat? Is that it? Who's sitting there?
My wife.
Huh? A lady? Oh, good. I knew there must be one here somewhere. I am I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. This is we're talking about the car on the way out here. This is to kind of amplify what Jim was saying. He called me and asked me if I'd like to come out here and talk, and I had given one talk before, I guess, and I was feeling grumpy, and they couldn't get anybody to come out and speak on Christmas Eve. Paul Van H. wasn't speaking anywhere else. He just wanted to go out and speak on Christmas Eve. Nobody decent did. And so they asked me, and I said, sure, because I thought I was ready to make my move. And I didn't have any front teeth, but I learned to carry them when I looked like this. So and I got somebody to give me a ride out here, and I had a sport jacket from somebody, and I went out to the basement of this American Legion Hall. There were about 20 people in Christmas Eve, and the Christmas tree looked kind of faded and down, and the decorations were falling off, and they sat there like about 20 neurotic misfits spending New Year's Christmas Eve at the American Legion Hall. And I wasn't feeling very well, and I was glad to be there, and I figured I'm a long way out of town. Anything I say here will never get back to Los Angeles. And so I told them that I thought Christmas was a bunch of crap, and it was a commercial thing, and I was alone. I lived in a little apartment in Hollywood, bachelor apartment. My children were, I'll never see them again. They lived in Texas, my wife, and they had a good career, and that was gone. I had nothing going for me. I had a little job working, and it wasn't very much of a job. And maybe at that time, it was wrapping packages, maybe. And I had been something once, and it was just crappy. And I sent some presents to my kids a few days before that, and I said, as far as I'm concerned, Christmas is a bunch of crap. And it may be all right for people in the commercial interest, but it's no place for anybody who has any emotions or feeling. And I sat down. I felt maybe I overshot, but, you know, who cares? It didn't matter to me. It looked like I was talking to a painting, you know. And Jim sidled up after the meeting. He was young and had black hair at that time and remembers what he was saying. I must say, the program tonight, the leader, Chapter 5, Traditions, and I, is like visiting God's waiting room. Each of us are waiting to wonder, will it be me next? But isn't it all entirely bad being old? There's something that I've mentioned before in our group, and I don't know if I've mentioned it out here, but one of the drawbacks of being old is that you don't have all the fire you used to have. And I've been taking iron tablets for about a year now for my blood, to build up my blood. And somebody about a month ago talked me into trying a Viagra tablet. I like to experience everything, so I took a Viagra tablet. I had no idea that if you're taking iron tablets, you should not take Viagra. Now every 4 hours I face north. Yeah. But anyway, Jim, I'm so cute I can hardly bear it. But Jim came sidling up to me, and I thought he was going to come up and denounce me. He said, well, you really got a bad attitude. You want to speak here again next year? I said, sure. And I gave kind of the same talk next year, except there was a little light at the end of the tunnel. They didn't like to hear that, but I gave it to them anyway. And you want to speak here next year? And so now this is my 39th talk at Christmas out here over a long period of time. And these guys participating in it were all at that meeting. There's something to be said about going to meetings on Christmas Eve, I guess, because the ones who didn't come, a lot of them aren't here. Here's the fun of it. How many people were here that night, that first night? One, two. He was here? Yeah. That's kind of interesting. 20% of them were here, and some of them are dead. And so it's kind of interesting that people should stay here. And now I've been coming out here a lot of times, and it's great. We out here talk about the same thing, about the misconceptions about my illness and the misconceptions that almost killed me and that do kill others and may kill me. You know, it's an interesting thing. We were talking a little bit on the way out here tonight about people slipping, because everybody in my car was a long-term slipper. And it really was a slipping frenzy. Some of us have been sober a while. Some of us have still got counter sobriety in days, but we're all in Alcoholics Anonymous together. And sometimes it's so baffling to try to explain this to people, because why do some people get drunk again and some don't? And some people seem to not have to go to meetings. They don't get drunk. They don't do any of the things we do. They don't get drunk. And other people do a half-hearted effort, and they do get drunk. At least they're doing something. And I've given that a lot of thought over the years. I've talked to a lot of people, and just kind of oversimplified. I think that the baffling thing about this is that there are various types of drinkers, apparently, who drink alcoholically. And one type that most of us are familiar with is, or have heard about, who drink a lot, get in trouble, have bad things, I mean, drink too much, but something dramatic happens in their life, and it shocks them into sobriety, and they don't drink anymore. They don't go to AA, they don't do anything. They just don't drink anymore. And people like that were held up to me a lot in my lifetime. Why can't you be like him? He drank too, and he stopped. He had the decency to stop. Then there's a second type, I think, that become physiologically addicted to alcohol. And these are the people that traditionally over the years have to be hospitalized or go to a detoxification center or do something like that. And they, for instance, up in Seattle, they have the Schick Shadel Clinic, where they specialize in people like this. They have a 7-day course, and they advertise. They used to advertise a lot, not so much anymore, but we can cure alcoholism in 7 days. And they have a list of people they've cured, and there's no question about it. And you wonder how that, you know, but that's another type, the ones that have to be withdrawn. And then there's another type, the type we are, who sometimes have to be withdrawn, sometimes not, sometimes stop through dramatic effect, sometimes have difficulty, sometimes have go to all the things that other alcoholics do, and we stop drinking and inexorably start again. And there's no rhyme or reason to it, and no one can figure out why, and it's always the bafflement of all time to all people who try to help alcoholics. What in hell is wrong with you? We got you straightened out, and now I'm just arbitrarily you go get drunk. I think a classic case of that happened in our group a few years ago. A woman who has been a very, very successful AA member and was a very good speaker. She spoke all over the country and was very successful. And she had the back problem. Her sponsor says, okay, to take this ongoing medication. So she took the medication and eventually overtook them and eventually got drunk. And she came back to AA then. You know, she'd been sober 17 years. And she came back to AA. And 2 weeks later, she was drunk. And she had a terrible time. She came back to AA. And a month later, she was drunk. And she came back to AA. I'll tell you how bad it got for her. They sent her to the Pacific Group. And we worked with her. I talked to her every day, just about. And I'd go down to Orange County and talk. And there's another person down there that I sponsored. We'd work together. And after about 2 months, she called me up one day. I got, was it a test or not? She says, just want you to know I got drunk last night. I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. She said, does this mean you're firing me? I said, no. But that's once. There's no twice. That's once. Because if you do it twice, there's nothing more I got more to tell you. And so she really put an effort in. And over a period of time, she stayed sober. And she went to a meeting. Went to a lot of meetings. We talked every day. She did what I told her. She finally subordinated her willfulness. And she forgot that she'd been a famous speaker and was just a goof trying to stay sober. And we finally got her a job and another little job, and she went to work every day. And after 8 months or 9 months, she finally got custody of her 2 boys. We thought that would never happen. But her ex-husband was now on cocaine, and he couldn't take care of them, and so we got her to take it. And she got a job. And I'll tell you, one of the nicest moments of my life was giving her a one-year cake at the Pacific Group some years ago. And the next month, I was coming back from a trip, and I got a call. She says, oh, I hate to tell you this, but I got drunk over the weekend. I said, how in the world could you get drunk over the weekend? She said, well, I was feeling so good, I wouldn't think one beer would hurt me. And she could never stay sober again. And last I heard, she was a prostitute on the streets in Newport Beach, living on people's front lawns. And nothing that I know, and everything I know, could help her. If there were, I'd certainly give it to her. And you wonder, how can this be? Why would this be? And all of us have been around any length of time, have seen people come and stay sober and leave. And there's no rhyme or reason. There's eight seats here. If we had eight newcomers there tonight, and if they all went to the same meetings, they all had the same sponsor, all did the same things, I think it's safe to say that about half of them would be drunk in a few months. And why? Nobody knows why. It's just baffling. Bill Wilson, when he wrote this book, sensed this and did not have any perspective on it except that he watched it happen. And that's why again and again, as he gropes in this book, he talks about alcoholics of our type. He didn't know what the other types were, but he knew there were other types because they didn't seem to be able to need it. And they stayed sober. And alcoholics of our type were so frustrating. You know, and we talk about how wonderful it was for those early people. They were so dedicated. It wasn't wonderful for them. They were alcoholics. And, you know, we have it pretty good today. We have a body of evidence and a body of experience that we know just about what will keep us here if we choose to do it. And then they didn't have that body of experience. They were half in the Oxford group and half in the AA and not knowing what's going on. Some got to church. And the sad thing is this, the first edition of the big book, that big red book, 2/3 of the stories in there were written by people who died drunk. And the next printing, half of the people died drunk. And the next printing, most of the people died drunk. And how could this be? These were people talking from success. And how could this be? And that's the bafflement that attacks all of us when we allow ourselves to get pulled out of ourselves long enough to listen to anything except the palpitations of our own self-obsession. And it's a difficult thing to understand. That's why we can gather together. As I say, we can all gather together again and again. And some people will inexorably march out and drink. We were talking on the way out here again about people who think their case is different, which is the great reason, of course, that AA stumbled upon this. There should not be special interest meetings. The tradition points that no group of three or more have some other thing except AA. Why is that? Because all of us feeling different have a tendency to cluster with other people who also feel different, and we can tell each other that it is our occupation, for example, that makes us different. Because we are all pilots. We don't have to follow the same rules little people do. We are all lawyers. We are all doctors. And these organizations really have terrible rates of failure, except for those that come in there, get some identification, then go into general AA. Why would it be so necessary to go into general AA? It's another problem. Why wouldn't I be better served by being with people like me? I know when I was kind of new, there was a meeting. I'm quoting myself a lot tonight, but I'd like to hear it. When I was about 2 years sober, there was a very famous actor who had a meeting in his garage in Beverly Hills. And there were all famous actors who went there. They've been going there for years. In fact, in the 1960 International Convention, in the program, it was written up about the famous garage group. And God, I moved heaven and earth to try to get to that meeting. I mean, you could take the boy out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, but you can't take Eau Claire, Wisconsin out of the boy. I had become a star then myself. And I moved heaven and earth to try to get that. I sucked around some dreadful people just to simulate interest in their tedious crap. And I finally got an invitation to this meeting. I was just so thrilled. We went up to this garage was better than most people's homes. We sat upstairs in paneled walls, and there they were, just, oh yeah, I saw you. I concealed my lack of front teeth. And they went around the room and they talked. It was just like going to a movie festival. And I felt they'd all been going there for years. I was only 2 years sober, such a crap. Now, the way home, it suddenly struck me. I had the most sobriety in the room. Because they all understood each other's slips, because it's so tough to be an actor. And most of them died drunk, one just recently. And again and again. And yet, you think there'd be some easy solution to it, but there isn't apparently any easy solution. And that's why people like us keep coming here, and people like us keep, some of us keep leaving here. And that's why we have these meetings, I guess, to gather together to exchange our experience, strength, and hope, to see if we can find some way through the cane break that there's somebody with a machete has made a little bit of a path anyway, so we can get through here. And that's one of the reasons for, I guess, this meeting, to come to understand that many of us have come here and did not succeed. Some have failed. Some died. I see alcoholics die intermittently on a regular basis in my job today. And I know a way out. But they don't want to hear it because they know I don't understand. And I think, how can you act so stupidly? And then I look back and think, year after year after year, I sat in AA meetings and people tried to help me, and I just knew they didn't understand. I'm sure they must have felt, you dumb little son of a bitch, how can you act so stupidly? You're dying. To find myself coming out of the Texas Insane Asylum off 36 electric shock treatments as a successful suicide and staying on Thorazine and going to AA and finding myself at the end of a year since my suicide, find myself in Juarez and saying, at midnight, it won't count anymore. And I had a couple drinks. I didn't get drunk. Next night I had a couple drinks at dinner. I went down to the club to get my token for being sober a year. Guys, I don't believe I can give you this. You've been drinking? And I said, yes, I had a couple drinks for dinner. I said, am I supposed to give you this? And I said, you get it for being sober a year. I was sober a year. Give me the goddamn token. I still have that somewhere as a living, breathing example of my sincerity and warmth. And the last, on a morning very similar to this evening, kind of a cold drizzle, a little colder than this, I found myself standing on a street corner downtown Los Angeles, and I knew as much about AA, I felt, as anyone who'd ever tried to help me, said, made a point of going to meetings and listening to it, but they had nothing for me. And I stood in a street corner, and as I've said before, if an old guy would have come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 125 pounds, maybe. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your home. You've lost your career. You used to be considered a boy genius. Now you can't get a job washing dishes. You've lost your clothing. Somewhere between Dallas and here on this run, your clothing is gone. All you got left is what you got on. You got no money. Your front teeth are kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank on the way west. So even if you do get some clothing, you're not going to get a job. They're not going to hire a bum like you. Now, you're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to accept phone calls from you anymore because your stepfather's so tired of watching you manipulate her to get some money for a new start and then break her heart one more time till she can't stand it. Now, you've been going to AA about 10 years now, fooling them, being superior to them. Why don't you just go back to AA this time and confess you're an alcoholic and do something about it? And if some guy had said that to me, if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, but if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd had to tell him, pal, you got it wrong. It isn't the way it looks. I'm not questioning the fact that I'm down and out, it's all gone to the wind, like Tara. But it's not because I'm an alcoholic. I know there's something wrong with me. I've noticed since I was a little boy, varying things. And I've examined it and tried to see it, and I've gone to doctors. And there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is, but I'm terribly depressed a great deal of the time. I've been hospitalized as a depressive, a suicidal. There's something inadequate about me. I wouldn't say these things if I knew that what they were. But at least I'd say to them, but I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. It would save a great deal of problem in my life. And if he'd say, well, prove you're not an alcoholic, I would not have been able to do that because I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and evaluate myself. So I probably would have done what frightened people like me do when they get cornered. They take refuge behind bluster. And you say things like, get out of my face. Screw you. Leave me alone. I didn't know the right answer. I know the right answer now. I've known it for a lot of years. It's quite obvious. I've seen it myself and countless others behind. The reason I knew I was an alcoholic was not anything. No metaphysical breakthrough. No big insight. No deep study. It was a very pragmatic thing. I'd been to a lot of meetings over the years. And if nothing else, I learned what an alcoholic was. And I wasn't that. So, you know, which begs the question, well, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody in this room knows what an alcoholic is. People driving by out here in Lark Ellen who've never heard of AA know what an alcoholic is. Alcoholics are people, there seem to be a number of them, who drink too much, or they get in trouble, their lives get screwed up, and as we know, eventually they get sent to a place like AA, and the AA sober them up, and they clean up their act, and then their lives get better. Isn't that true? In all the years I've slept, I heard that same story hundreds of times in various places. The specifics different. The details are very, very widely. But it's always the same basic thrust. I used to drink and my life was terrible. I came to AA, I got sober, and I've cleaned up my act, and now I'm feeling better. And so I've often thought about this. Over the years, in my desperation, I sold out my integrity every chance, not every chance I had. I thought I'd maintained it, but I sold it out in various jams. It always seemed ironic to me, the last maybe shred of integrity that I should hang on to was the one that would not admit that I was an alcoholic or find me. And the reason I knew I was an alcoholic was this. I drink like an alcoholic. I get in trouble like an alcoholic. I lose things. I'm dying on the streets. But I can't overcome this one difference. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And the longer I try to be good, the worse it gets. It's almost as though somebody has put a big spring inside of me. And it's just every day the pressure is just a little bit more. And over the years, I've tried a lot of things to get rid of it. I went to psychoanalysis, and I read books, and I read philosophers, and did a lot of things. But nothing has ever worked quite as effectively as something I found when I was 15 years old or run away from home out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in the Second World War, early in the Second World War. Some men got me to drink some whiskey, and I threw it up, and I felt embarrassed, so I tried to drink it again and again and again, and finally held a drink down. And that day I realized, if you can breathe and you don't vomit, it gets rid of that feeling. I didn't really consciously stand back and think that I've never had much of an overview of my life at all. That's one thing for some of you who are new, you hear speakers again and again talk about, and then in 1959, I realized that a new direction must be had. And in 1961, I took, it isn't that way at all. It's that way in retrospect. All of us are just like blind men running through the woods, just boom, 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 boom. Then later you try to put some pattern to it, I realized there was a tree there, and I... There's hardly any way out. But I've tried a lot of things to try to do it. They seem to work a little bit, but they never did. And I've quit drinking. If I thought drinking was the problem, and I quit drinking. People sometimes say, can you really quit if you have a good enough reason? A lot of people do. These dramatic, boy, I almost lost my family, so I quit right then. Now, I had as good a reason to quit as anybody I've ever known. I found myself in jail one night again. I was always in jail a lot overnight because I never committed any crimes, but I had an awful smart mouth. I taunted cops and did terrible things. And Dad came down to the jail cell the next morning and said, I hope you had a good time last night. He said, because your little son died and we couldn't find you to tell you. You ought to be ashamed. My father told me that. And I felt so bad, I almost went crazy because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. And so he actually had a little extra edge in my affection because he's one of a kind. And he died, and I had such hopes for him. And I remember sitting in our living room before the funeral. My wife's brothers had come in, and some of her relatives and a couple of mine. They sat there, and nobody said a word about this terrible thing to me at all. They smiled. You just see in their eyes, you dirty, rotten son of a bitch. I just cringe. I'd rather have him scream at me and hit me with a club. It's just terrible. And when we buried that little boy, I put my hand in his casket and I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen to another child in this family, ever. When I get drinking again, I will never let this happen. And I was working in Texas and I started drinking a little bit heavier and had a good job in an advertising agency. I was working night at the university and the faculty, and I was doing pretty good. And I started drinking a little bit, and somebody had a call to my attention. I was drinking a little too much. I suddenly realized, I mustn't let this happen again. So I stopped drinking. Now, you may wonder if you could stop drinking. I'll tell you, if you got a good enough reason, you could stop drinking for a while. But eventually, for people like me, one day you get up and the spring is there again. And little by little, and I had every reason to stop drinking. And the job I liked, I didn't like it anymore. And there were a bunch of idiots. I didn't like this town in Texas. I didn't like Texas. I didn't like the people, my children who I was doing it for. It just made me crazy with their noise. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Let Daddy alone. Just don't make all that screaming all the time. I'm sorry, I'll make it up. Tomorrow we'll do something. And it got so bad I couldn't stand it. And I look back with my overview now, and I know that I needed a drink to resolve those emotions. But at the time, there was no question about taking a drink. I was going to outweigh it. So one day my wife took the children to church, and I could not stand another day. I just pulled the car in the garage, took the hose in the exhaust pipe, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And I laid dead in that car, and the neighbor was watching, I guess, wondered why I didn't come out, and he ambled over, looked through the window and saw me slumped over the wheel and the motor running. And he rushed in and pulled me out, and they beat on my chest and breathed my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and examined me and determined I was seriously mentally ill, and put me in a locked ward and examined me some more and determined I was at best a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies, and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period, perhaps for the rest of my life. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's not what I would call your basic alcohol problem. That's something else, a little deeper than that. And I don't need some well-meaning smarmy ace saying, "Well, if you stop drinking, you'll be all right." Yeah. You don't understand, you old puke. And so I stood in that street corner. I knew what the hell I was going to do. I've done everything I know how to do, and it's all going down. Stood there and watched myself drip out my own sleeve, and not a goddamn thing I could do except rail at the injustice of it all. And I remember in the 3 or 4 weeks I'd been in Los Angeles roaming around, I'd first gone out to radio station at that time was a KFWB, and the lead disc jockey was a guy named Ted Quillen, who had given him a start in Texas, and he was now hotter, and he gave me some money. I said, "I've been a little down and out, and I need some money." He gave me some money, and I came back a couple weeks later drunk, and he said, "You're not down and out, you're a bum. You've become a bum." And he sent me away, and I hurt so bad. Somebody got took up to the AA club somehow, an AA club, and I hung around there, and I drunk and got thrown out of there finally. And it's just terrible. And I stood in the street corner, it was raining. I thought, "Where the hell can I go?" I thought, "I can go back to an AA club." Because AA is the only place in the world that you know the worse you look, the better you look. The smart ones can see through you, but there's always dumb ones who you can work with. And I didn't know how to get there. I said, "All I remember is on Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that is." And I said to somebody, "Where's Wilshire and Fairfax?" He said, "One Wilshire doesn't come all the way down here. You have to go up to Hill Street, then cut over to Fairfax, then go cover Wilshire, and go west." Yeah. I walked that day, and I counted later in my car 72 long blocks. That's a long way when you're sick and desperate, I'll tell you. A woman in New York asked me one time, she said, "How could you possibly walk that far when you were so sick and desperate?" And of course, the answer is quite simple. It's the only time you can. You could never do it any other time. But when you're sick and desperate, it's amazing what you can do. And I got to that club, and as soon as I saw it, my heart sunk. Because I remembered being in there, what a fool I'd made. But I had to get out of that cold rain. And I walked in there. They weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. And I hung around there all day, and I lurked. And they had a TV room upstairs, and I stayed there and watched TV. And at night, they had a meeting, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake. And this is some old fool talk about God, and I'm going to just almost puke the cake up again. And everybody went home. It's raining still a little bit. And I figured, "I'm going to hustle these people. I'm going to, you know, I don't want to sleep in the rain." So I went for the manager. He's the only one left. I said, "I'm a newcomer. I've come here to find a new way of life. I have no place to sleep." He said, "I got a deal for you." "Oh." He said, "A guy named Joe Quinn left an old green Mercury down in the parking lot last summer. It doesn't run, but it's dry. You can sleep in that." "You want me to sleep in an abandoned car?" I said, "Yeah, pretty lucky, huh?" I said, "Oh, geez." I went to sleep in that abandoned car, and I got up in the morning of Sunday, and they were having a spiritual meeting. I had about 4 pounds of cake and heard more about God and Jesus this time. And hung around the club. Thank God upstairs in the TV room they were playing pro football, so I could watch that, take my mind off everything. And then at night there was another meeting. I had 4 pounds of cake, and that night I went to sleep in the abandoned car, and I got up in the morning, went back in there, just the same hideous. The club was not only a club, but full of AA fanatics. I know of nothing more tedious to an intelligent slipper than to be surrounded by AA fanatics. Jesus, just
keep coming back. Live and let live. Program works. Oh, one step at a time. Just take it one day. Oh,
Jesus. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe my grandmother was right. Marrying a Catholic, this is what happens to you. Just... I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date, because I had no intention for it to be my sobriety date of all times I ever got sober. And I look back now and I think, what in the world enabled me to get sober? I'd like to know, not only for my own information, but people are always referring long-term slippers to me in hideous cases that they don't want to bother with. And I wish I had something to convey to them. I could give them some sentence that would turn their life around. And I've not been able to... I isolated once, but I didn't like the answer. A couple of years ago, I was talking at some kind of a 12-step seminar in Toronto. And I had to talk, do a question and answer meeting in the afternoon, then I spoke at night. And I understand now, I didn't until I heard the tape, that I have a facility. If someone asks me a question, I can't think of the answer right then. I can keep talking until I think of it. I weave a tapestry of BS is what I do, I guess. And one of the questions, a woman in the back said, "Clancy, if you don't mind, I don't want one of your long answers." Just a sentence or two. What was different this time? Put all that other stuff aside. And I could not think of an answer. I did not. And I was taking a shower that night. That was before I went to the meeting. And I thought, there must be an answer. And I thought of an answer, but it was such a dismal little answer, I just hate it. I mean, I like answers that have body and dynamic afterglow. That I want people to leave a meeting saying, "Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." It means nothing, but it gives people hope. "Did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night." I know the dismal answer that I thought of is so distressing it almost made me sad. This is the first time I ever began doing things that I disagreed with and I thought were stupid. Not much of a dynamic answer there, is it? But I've come to believe that is exactly the turning spot for people like me. To begin to do things that I think were stupid, and my integrity would not let me sink to that because it's so common, so dumb, so ordinary, so trite, so inane. And I don't mean that I didn't take a vow and say, "I think I'll do things that are stupid to me that I disagree with." I would never have sunk to that. But I look back now, and as far as I'm concerned, my life was changed because I was thrust among AA fanatics. I would not call them AA fanatics tonight. I would call them AA winners. Now, there's some new people back there lurking here and there. You'll hear that phrase again and again. "Stick with the winners. Stick with the winners." Who are the winners? Who are the winners? They don't wear signs. Maybe the people who have been sober the longest. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I know people who have been sober many, many years, who once upon a time were good AAs. Their souls, as far as I can see, have atrophied. They're just dry, sour, negative people. And if I get a chance, I tell newcomers to stay away from him, because all you'll hear from him is some kind of poison. So who are the winners? Well, as far as I can tell, based on my experience for the last number of years, they're the people who are currently sitting in these meetings on a continuing basis, who have come here feeling out of it, lost, alone, desperate as much as anybody in the room, have allowed themselves to be guided into doing things they didn't agree with and they thought were kind of stupid, but their desperation motivated them, and somehow their perceptions of reality changed, much to their surprise, and now they sit in these meetings on a continuing basis looking for new people to give those same guidances to. Now you'll hear also around these meetings, "Stay away from the losers, stay away from the losers." Who are the losers? Hard to tell. Sometimes they're funny, vivacious people. It's hard to tell a loser, really, sometimes. I'll tell you, if you hear him say this, you'll know it's a loser, and I hope you'll give him a big pass. Just little things like, oh, you don't have to do all that stuff. Your sponsor doesn't want you. Your sponsor is kidding. You have to do all the stuff your sponsor says. Come on. I'm sober and I don't do all that crap. That's nonsense. And I never could figure these guys out. You know, there's an old story. Most of us have heard it. I've talked about it before, but around 1900, there's four or five families in Boston who began getting typhoid fever. And there's no reason to get typhoid fever. There's no place that they could be getting it. Their sanitation was good. Their plumbing was good. The water was good. Everything was good. And they could not figure out why they were getting typhoid fever and dying. Except they ran along. They really investigated. They found out they had one thing in common. They'd all had the same cook at one time or another. A woman named Mary Callahan. And they found her. And she was a very, very rare case of a person who carried typhoid but was not affected by it. And she was a carrier, that's all. And she was appalled when she had heard that she gave these people she loved typhoid, she had killed them. She almost committed suicide. But that's where the term typhoid Mary comes from. People who carry the disease but don't seem to be affected by it. And there's some of those around AA, I suppose, when you look about it, they may be a different type of alcoholic. People who are able to stop without doing the things we do, that type 1 or type 2. But you stay away from those losers, they'll kill you. But why would you want to stay with the winners anyway, you know? Because mostly they are the activists in group. They are the people doing things. They are the people taking actions that keep us going. I remember standing around that club at night thinking things like, after being sober a few weeks, man, I'm sick of these stinking meetings. I'm not going to go to another meeting. I just can't stand it. Listen, and I'll see all these people tell how wonderful they are and how well they're doing, and nothing. I have no friends. I got nothing going for me. But I have to do, if I have to hold up a gas station, I got to get some money and get some front teeth and get some money and go to New York and go back to do what I do well. I can't even get a chance to do this anymore. I'm just out. If I could just do that, no more meetings. Just how what can I do? Let me say, come on, Cassie, time to get in the car and go to the meeting. They just pull you along. Come on, Classy. Time to help Fred move his furniture. Oh, shit. On and on. And I stayed sober under terrible conditions. Waiting to make my move. And eventually, they said the same thing they say now. Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor. I've had sponsors a lot. You know, you sponsors are people you try to, if they're nice, you be nice to them. If they got something to give you, take it and stay away from them. And I saw this actor. He was a character actor. He was playing a lot of loving roles in the movies. It seemed once in a while he was giving people money or taking, he's a brother-in-law or a favorite uncle. And I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? He said, yes, I will, but I want you to do what I say. Oh, sure. I do newcomer well, I'll tell you. I certainly rehearsed it long enough. And I've said this many times, but he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because they were foreign to his nature. He's a right-wing fascist AA pig. And he got me taking actions that I just thought were beyond my belief. You know, I often when I look back and think, why would I take that? Because I didn't take any crap from anybody. That was a mark of distinction. And I look back now, and working with others, I've seen it in them, and I can now see it myself. Why I wouldn't take crap from people? Because I was always concealing my inner weakness. I knew I was weak, and I couldn't bear to have people find it out. And so I would never let anybody imply I was weak. I wouldn't let anybody tell me what to do, because I'd imply I was weak. I've quit jobs I've worked years to get because somebody gave me a boss might imply that I was not doing it right. I've gotten a lot of barroom fights. I'm not built to be a barroom fighter. But I've been in a lot of barroom fights where somebody might imply I might not be a real man. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Try me. Hope to get the first punch and then be pulled off. There's a technique to that. Now, this guy, you know who I like? I've always liked in those years especially. I like people who like me. I think they're stupid. I have no respect for them. I like them. I hate people who can see through me because they can see I'm weak and a phony and a quitter. And I hate them. And that sponsor, I guess, was a strange thing. He could see through me, and I hated him. But he also liked me. And he'd give me a pat in the back once in a while. And I did things to get a pat in the back from that man I wouldn't have done for my mother, for an employer, for baby Jesus. I wouldn't have done it for nobody.
You did good, kid.
And over a period of time, he took advantage of my pain and made me do things. That's the thing, interesting thing about pain here, because pain is what causes people like us to drink, psychic pain, I suppose, emotional pain. I think all the time, I've used this analogy many times, I don't know a better way to say it. Because I've been sober a long time, I've been active a long time, I've had a chance to be asked to come and speak in exotic places, Johannesburg and Cape Town and Oslo, and a couple months ago I was in Ireland, and earlier this year I was in Australia for a week, and New Zealand, and Berlin, and Paris, a lot of places. So I ride a lot on airplanes. I like the SST because you really shoot there. But they're only going to SST when you land. You figure, I hope you have good brakes on this, baby. Because, you know, we'll be in Brussels, Belgium airport. But, of course, they don't ever use brakes on airplanes. I'm sure if you know that. They take the jets and they reverse the thrust of them. The same jets that push you this way, they reverse the thrust and the jets stop you. They may have a little handbrake for the gate, but that's how they stop an airplane. And I've come to understand in much the same manner, that's the way it is, in my opinion, with AA. The same pain that drives me to distraction and eventual drinking or suicide, if I can allow someone to change the thrust of that pain, it can be used to get me to take actions that I would never take by choice at any time. And if I do that, eventually it gets better. But the problem is, how can you find somebody that you can trust enough to allow that to happen? I know you mean well, pal, but you can't possibly know as much about me as I do. I've seen come to AA, desperate, and losers, and failures. I sometimes, that Pacific group out on the west side must be two-thirds or three-fourths full of long-term slippers who have failed everywhere else, have come there, and have been sucked into the action and are staying sober. It's really a remarkable thing. And what is so good about action? I don't know. But I know one thing has enabled me to stay sober long enough to discover that I was an alcoholic. Tonight, if you're new, I said, my name is Clancy and I'm an alcoholic. You may wonder, well, when did he ever become an alcoholic? Was the alcoholic when he drank? Was the alcoholic when he got sober? What transpired to make him an alcoholic? I stayed sober long enough, doing inane, dumb things, surrendering to people, other people's will for me, having lost the sense of defiance that just didn't give a damn anymore. I guess that's the best. That may or may not be it. I don't know. Long way to look back. But just hopelessness. Just, okay. And do dumb things and not care how I look. And little by little do these things. And somehow find that my perception changes a little bit, little by little. And I no way to describe that, to understand that. As Chuck C. used to say, you can't see until you can see, and you can't hear until you can hear, and you can't make anybody see until they're ready to see, and you can't make anybody hear, because their mind won't let them. But here, somehow, the greatest thing I lasted to learn was that the one thing that always held me back, I'm sure it holds you back, a man went out and got a bottle of pop and didn't bring any for us. Well... You probably wish they had a coffee break. I didn't need one. The one thing that helped me back was the knowledge, but my problem really isn't alcohol. My problem really isn't alcohol. It's emotion and feelings and terrible feelings of inadequacy sometimes and feelings of superiority and inadequacy. I feel above people, below people, above people, below people. I just never feel equal to people, ever. Just maybe going by briefly. I was equal or familiar. How could I be an alcoholic when my problem is an alcohol? And taking inane and stupid actions, I survived long enough to discover that this book says specifically, my problem is not alcohol. I couldn't believe it. Because I read that book, I never saw that. But if you're new tonight, you may think, of course the problem is alcohol. That's what AA is about. If alcohol were the problem, detoxes would turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers would turn out recovered people. Hospitals, jails, they turned out sober people with varying amounts of information what may be wrong with it. But I'll guarantee you, if they'd be like me, and I presume like you if you're here, if you could stop somewhere else, you would have done it. You will discover that stopping drinking has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. And then people want to tell you your problem is drinking. And as the book says so well, God, that's a great line in there. There seems to be a time at which there is no adequate defense against the first drink. I just can't stand it. Now, what do you do then? What's the problem then if it isn't alcohol? Well, it's something we hear a lot about, and I'm sure everyone in this room knows what it is. It's something called alcoholism. And the difference is just that. Alcohol problems are overcome by stopping drinking and shaping up. Alcoholism, this thing that looks exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, fatal thing called alcoholism, leads you into believing you're going to be well as you gradually get so bad that you cannot bear it. Until it gets to a point where you must drink to stand it. Now, a lot of people have problems in the world. Psychiatrist couches are full all over the country. Why don't they all drink and get feeling better? Because it turned out there's only about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% of people, and nobody knows why or how, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And the problem for people like me and you is that none of us ever know it's an unnatural reaction because you have nothing to compare it against. It's like saying, do strawberries taste unnatural to you? I don't know. They taste like strawberries. Is that unnatural? I don't know what the hell it's supposed to taste like. So the problem then gets to be, what is the unnatural effect? Is that makes you act crazy? You hear these speakers say, and I escaped from prison, raped 4 nuns, and went to the mental hospital. No, that isn't it. I see people die who have never acted crazy once. Well, not even once. Makes you stay drunk all the time. I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. No human body can stay drunk 2 straight weeks. What is this unnatural act? It's something that's so simple I never would have guessed it in 1,000 years. It must have the power to almost instantly make everything all right. That's all. You think, oh, that's no big deal. It's a big deal. Most people we envy drink, and they have a little drink, and eventually they get a little dizzy. They don't feel good. And they say, no more for me. I cannot understand why they don't drink. And they can never understand why I do. Look, you've ruined your life, you've ruined my life, you've ruined the children's life, and here you are, goddamn you, drinking again. Well, leave me alone. Never the twain shall be. And this thing called alcoholism is a brutal thing. Today in America, there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world. It's estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. A number of people in this room are going to die drunk. Maybe there's ones that are feeling best tonight. I don't know. Maybe me. Maybe you. I know when my sponsor told me that 40 years ago, I thought he just tried to scare me, the old sumbitch. But a few years later, when he got mad at AA and stopped going to meetings and he died drunk, that convinced me. He was right. He was an alcoholic of my type. That's why you can't put any stake in whether or not somebody who used to drink doesn't need the therapy here. You and I need. The problem is this. There are 2 kinds of illnesses, I suppose. There's acute illnesses and chronic illnesses. Acute illness, something like pneumonia, where you get so sick you're almost dead. They put you in the hospital, do heroic measures, they bring you back, and after a while your body builds up, you're okay again. Fine. And then there's a chronic illness, like something like diabetes, where you get so sick and you almost die, and they go to the hospital, they get acute measures, they finally bring you back, and you get okay again, and you're fine. Except you must now watch your diet, perhaps take insulin and take exercise and do things. And then you'll keep feeling good. And so often, what kills diabetics, they watch people who have recovered from other illnesses, and they don't do these things, and I don't do them. That's what kills people who have bad hearts. Because they get back and they do their exercise, they do these things, and little by little they get boring. I don't take all the exercises. And I indulge myself in a little food. And now this has been written up in medically, read a great article on this, and the attrition pattern. Little by little, stopping doing things, and it's all right. I don't do this so much anymore. It's all right. I don't walk in the morning. It's all right. And one day they drop dead of a heart attack. How could that be? Same way that people here, little by little, cut the mooring lines that hold us at the dock, and one day a storm comes up and we drift off. How could that be? I was doing so well, and all of a sudden I got drunk. Nobody ever suddenly gets drunk around here, I don't think. You have to cut a lot of mooring lines, and you got to cut yourself off little by little. And if you can learn that, that's why we do these things. Now, I'm not going to AA because I'm afraid I'm going to get drunk. I'm going to AA because once upon a time, I did these dumb things, and much to my surprise, my perceptions changed enough to realize that this is the easiest possible way I've ever had to go. I have never, almost never in AA, tried as hard as I tried almost every day on those streets when I was trying to fight booze. God, I said, I have something to think about the co-founder, Bill. We talk about Bill Wilson and his great spiritual experience. My heart goes out to Dr. Bob, who got sober and craved alcohol every day for the first few years. And how grateful he was. He said, at last the terrible craving has left me. He'd been sober several years. So he prayed a great deal. He was very much into the Oxford movement, which was more into prayer. Bill Wilson seemed to do better than his followers because they were more into action. Because it turns out that action here is what does it. Nobody knows why. You know, you hear again and again in AA, well, sobriety's a gift. You don't go to AA to get sobriety. Sobriety's a gift. And it certainly is. There isn't anybody drinking who doesn't get sober again and again and again. Your body makes you get sober. Your body fights for survival. Your body will set up all sorts of defenses. It will make you refuse the entrance of alcohol by passing out. When you get your body highly toxified from alcohol, it'll fight back. It'll set up a series of involuntary physiological reflexes that bring about a state of reverse peristalsis. We know that as puking in our circles. I'm sure there isn't anybody in this room like me who hasn't knelt in front of the old porcelain altar in the morning and said, oh God. You hardly ever think your body's helping you. Stop helping me. Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will remove alcohol from both ends at once. Which is great for your body, but it's hell on your nerves. You got to make a series of split-second decisions, and every answer must be right. But you will always get sober. And they say sobriety is a gift. So why do people come to AA and get drunk again? Because they don't understand, to put it nicely, this gift comes in kit form. Once upon a time, I was advertising director for a big firm called Revell, which made hobby kits. And I remember thinking about that, and I forgot it again for 30 years, but it's a good... But that's what AA is. It's a kit. It's a gift. Here's your gift. Thank you. Well, it's just a bunch of little boards. Yeah, you got to put them together, goof. The kit's here. And nobody ever does it very well. But we get a kit called sobriety. And you have to put it together. And if you can sit there till you're dead and take a Revell box and learn all about it, read the instructions. If you don't do it, you got a box. That's all you got. And so that's one thing we have to reinforce one another. It's so easy after we get feeling better here. Very few people have any problems when they're really desperate. It's when you feel better. Those mooring lines start to go little by little. And you drift. I'm all right. I don't need all those beans anymore. I'm doing fine. See you around. And one day they're gone. And some people can do that. But I'll tell you, not alcoholics of our type. You better find alcoholics of our type to be with and ride herd on you, or you most certainly will have a terrible long old life and bad life. You know, in closing, I'm thinking about it a little bit recently. People, we have new people here tonight. And this thing that new people traditionally say, and the terrible long-term slippers, and other people say. They say, but how does AA work? Okay, I'll be willing to do it. How does AA work?
We have a chapter that deals with that called Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen it personal.
But that isn't what they mean. They mean, why does it work? Why does all that crap make people stay sober that have never in the history of mankind, in 5,000, 6,000 years of alcoholic history, never had a way where alcoholics could stay sober? And here's some thing that doesn't even seem to make some tenuous kit made up of balsa wood. Why does that work? And I think about a classic story. And some of you know it already, I'm sure. But in the 1700s, the worst plague extant in the civilized world was smallpox. They had bubonic plague in the 15th century and then other plagues. But this was an ongoing thing, you know, just dying, just waves of epidemics of smallpox. They had no idea what was going on. In Philadelphia, you're reading a book, what's called Bring Out Your Dead. Just in all the cities, people just take their bodies out, get the grandmother up and throw her on the dead wagon because she's dead. We've got to get her out of here. Just, and nobody could understand because there was no knowledge of microbes, no knowledge of bacteria, no knowledge of anything. And a guy named Dr. Edward Jenner, he was so troubled by this, and he noticed something that was kind of unusual. Girls who milk cows never got smallpox. Why in the hell would that be? Was there something about cows that made them? Then he talked to them even further, and they all had had something called cowpox, which was a mild illness. They got sick and got better. And he couldn't understand any reason, because they thought smallpox was caused maybe by the moon or by the winds or what the who, maybe rats, who knows? No knowledge of bacteria. But he decided to do something about it, to test it. And he bought a little boy. And to some of us, his name is familiar because I use it a lot in a joke, but his name was Jimmy Phipps. He bought a little 9-year-old boy named Jimmy Phipps, and he took him into the cowpox, where the girls had cowpox, and he cut his arm. He didn't know what this could do, maybe to help. He took a lot of pus off a girl with cowpox and rubbed it in her arm. And the kid got sick, got cowpox, and got better. Then he thought, I don't know why this should have happened, but took him to the smallpox ward where people are dying of smallpox. And he cut his other arm after eventually and rubbed pus from a dying woman into his arm. And Jimmy Phipps got sick and got better. And in some way they could never understand for 150 years. Somehow cowpox kept you from getting smallpox. Why in the world? No one ever guessed. And that's when they began giving people cowpox. It's an interesting thing. The Latin word for cow is vaccus. The root of the word vaccination, injection of the cow. About 150 years later, they finally discovered there are things called microbes and bacteria, and that the microbes and bacteria of cowpox set up antibodies against smallpox. But they didn't know it until they'd been giving vaccinations for 150 years. I sometimes get the feeling that maybe in AA, maybe 150 years from now, some social scientist will make a breakthrough and discover taking a certain number of inane actions, subordinating oneself to power drunk sponsors, taking actions, confessing your sins, getting out of self as painful as it may be, creates an unbreakable wave of endorphins to the cerebral cortex. Or something. And then we'll know why AA works. But you and I will never be around to see it. We cannot wait to find out why. We have to take our vaccinations, whether we believe it or not, because it's the only thing that works for people like us. And that's why we get together at a time like this. Christmas is a wonderful thing, but for people like us who must live with our emotions, we have to make sure that you enjoy Christmas if you wish. But in my early sobriety, I had to set myself aside because I'm such a sentimentalist, I can binge out on it. I have never, in all these years, I have never on Christmas afternoon felt I got what I wanted. I don't know what I wanted, but I know I didn't get it. Sometimes they were close. I begged them to try harder. But so we get together, and that's why you stay active in AA. I can't understand me. He said, we won't have any meeting next week. It's Christmas Eve. We won't have any meeting next week. It's Christmas night. My boss where I work says, you're having a meeting on Christmas night? I said, you bet. That's what we needed. Some people needed the most. Just like that little cluster of 20 people in the basement of the American Legion Hall in 1960. John Kennedy had just been inaugurated. That's a long time ago. And all the years since then. I met my friend Vince Y. Speaks at the Pacific Group on the Wednesdays before Christmas and always denounces everything I've said out here. It's a wonderful feeling. Enjoy it, enjoy it. But he didn't always enjoy it either. but I don't judge him. Except incessantly when I see him. But that's why we say to you, if you're kind of new and having a difficult time, don't feel bad that you can't have a total fruition of all your dreams on Christmas. You know, that's not necessary. Because remember, for you and me, April 21st is as important as December 25th, and June 16th, and August 3rd. And so when we come together like this tonight, we can't do it in the world out there, because people think we're crazy. But try not to get caught up in that terrible emotional maelstrom. Not that there's anything wrong with Christmas, but emotional people have a tendency to want more out of it than there's possibly in it, and we're always disappointed. And then I want to leave by saying tonight, you know, I'm not going to wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry March 9th and a very prosperous September 14th and a happy and fulfilling November 2nd, because these are all the days in which we must live and do these things and find help and accept help and put aside the defiance that weak people must use to show that they're intellectual or strong. When you become strong enough, you can afford to be weak. And then you got to survive long. So we have to survive long enough to become strong enough so we can be weak. And when that day comes, it's been all worth waiting for. So have a nice July 10th. Thank you.